recording.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Show's on. Show's ready to go.
Phil, where are you?
Phil? Oh, I am at Niagara Falls.
You stayed in Niagara Falls.
Yeah, I'm staying here at a hotel right now with my wife and my sister Liz.
Mm-hmm.
She says hello. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a bit of a treat because I booked a hotel that is right in front of the path that leads to Table Rock. And so you can either walk down or take the incline railway down.
Mm.
So we did that. We bought some tickets. And
what's Table Rock?
Oh, you know what Table Rock is? It's, it's that little... Well, it's that platform where you can see Horseshoe Falls. Oh. Now, right behind it, there's a shop and Journey Behind the Falls, and there's a bridge that leads to parking, or there's this railway that goes up and down like an elevator.
Did you go behind the falls?
We did that in August. Oh. So, like in November, you'd probably freeze to death.
I'm more interested in this. When just before we began, you were giving Pearl and your sister shit for taking too long for breakfast?
Oh, no, no, not that. It's just breakfast in this hotel starts at 6:30, and I said, come on, well, I got to go prepare for work and stuff like that, so we should have a nice quick breakfast. And so it was like 7:10, and they were still eating. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll go upstairs first. And so they just knocked the door because neither of them have room keys. They forgot to bring it with them.
All right.
So.
All right. You lead a complicated life, Phil Hong.
You know, the hotel says you can only eat for 20 minutes in the breakfast room. It is Niagara Falls.
But so what, do they come in and throw you out after 20 minutes?
Basically. But the thing is, I guess the lady's too nice downstairs because they were away for an hour.
Was there a lineup or something?
Not in November. There's probably 6 or 7 guests in this entire hotel, which is good for them.
So the whole point of you going there was to see the lights on the falls, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The winter lights... what are they called? The Winter Festival of Lights.
Right.
And then it's just nice to be able to walk around the city without being squished by every tourist you can think of.
By the way, I think towards the end of the show, Mike Boone's going to check in because he was a little disappointed yesterday with your response to the new Asian Muppet that has that has been introduced to Sesame Street. Mike is in a mixed marriage. He has an Asian wife, and his children are... part Asian, and he was a little disappointed with your response, so he's going to check in and have something to say about that. Well, just so you know.
Well, good for him. Good for him. I just, when it comes to issues of ethnicity, there are folks who have extremely strong opinions, and I don't understand why.
All right. So I just wanted to warn you. He wanted more out of you, Phil. All right,
Dan. In our first studio, we had a guy who worked for the studio next door. Yeah. And he's like, Phil, you are the least Chinese person I've ever heard from. And it's like, I don't understand you.
All right. Well, you can discuss that with Boone, because I'll tell you, he's passionate about it. He was trying to get through yesterday, and he called me yesterday. Yeah.
I want to have an hour chat about the Sesame Street thing.
Okay, let's begin.
The following episode of Humble and Fred is brought to you by the Retirement Sherpa, Gig Sky, The Chambers Plan, Health Gauge, Bodog, and our newest sponsor, Dewar, D-U-E-R, the world's most comfortable pants. If you'd like to talk to Humble and Fred, our Twitter handle is Humble Fred Radio. And now from the remote headquarters of the Humble and Fred Show, here are Dan and Fred.
Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
And hello to you again, Dan. Did you enjoy your day in the big city yesterday?
Yeah, I did. I went for a walk. Didn't see a whole lot of stuff around here. I mean, there's, you know, it's a busy area. Mm-hmm. Making bigger plans today, though. I'm going to go back to where I used to live in Toronto and hang out in that area, see the coffee shop. And then I'm getting together with some relatives for the evening tonight.
Go look at your house there in Bloor West Village. That's worth about $4 million.
Yeah.
That one?
Yeah, the one I sold at the exact wrong time. Yeah, that one. I am not.
We were talking about that last night. Because Danny. Oh, there's Pearl there. There's for our television audience. There's Pearl waving and Phil pushing her away. We were talking about that. My son Danny had gone to see a few houses in that area just out of curiosity, and your house came up and what it would be worth today. But again, you sold it 10 years ago, so don't beat yourself up, Dan.
Right, in 2008, which was probably the worst time to sell a house. So, yeah, we did okay and got into the next house in, you know, in the same year. So wasn't that
big? It's all relative, Dan.
Yeah.
Today, I thought we'd concentrate, as we often do on this show, on the weather.
Oh.
On the weather, because, again, I'm going to South Carolina next week, so I've been checking the weather, you know, 7 days ahead, 14 days ahead, as you do.
Isn't there a bit of a storm going on next week?
No. Down there?
Yeah, I thought there was.
Oh, bite your tongue. Oh. Really? No, not what I see. It's all it's 16, 17, 18, nice golfing weather.
Oh, okay.
There's the threat of rain one day. I made some calls yesterday, doing some pre-planning for my PCR test, which we will require before coming home, but that's besides the point.
You got that figured out then?
Sort of. Anyway, and then I looked at Venice to see how it is with Howard. And we're talking 11, 12, sunny, no rain. That's comfortable for walking around Venice and, you know, parts of Italy, going to Florence and stuff. The next few days, it's going to be hanging in around that temperature. That's nice for touring.
Yes. He sent me a picture yesterday of where he was.
He didn't send me a picture.
I guess he was worried about, you know, me taking his place here. Just wanted to check in, make sure everything's fine.
Well, that's interesting, because if you sent me a picture and he didn't get one, he'd be In fact, he would probably text you and say, why?
Yeah.
Why did you send Fred a picture and not me?
Am I not your friend anymore? Where are you on the best friend scale?
Mm-hmm. What was the picture of?
It was a nighttime picture, because he sent it about 8 o'clock their time, which is 1 o'clock our time, right? And it was just of one of the canals and the lighting on the canal, the Venice canals. And I texted him back, wow, your life is a travel brochure right now. It's stunning.
Which is pretty cool, again, because, you know, there's you don't have to deal with crowds.
Right.
When I've been to Italy a couple of times, you know, not only was it punishingly hot, but there's a lot of people there because you go in the summer. But anyway, it looks like he's going to have decent weather. Hey, all you could want in November in Italy. And for that, I am very happy for him.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like it is with me, the weather's a very important thing. And then last night out in Edmonton, talking about the weather, there was a soccer game.
Right.
Canada played Mexico in World Cup qualifying, and Canada won 2-1.
So Canada
is fantastic.
Yeah, so what does that mean? What does that mean for Canada?
Well, it means Canada, apparently they're in first place in that group, and their chances of qualifying for the World Cup in decades is very, very good.
You mean the World Cup that everybody talks about, the big one?
Yes, the World Cup. Maybe the biggest sporting event in the world.
Wow.
In fact, that's not even a stretch, is it, Phil? The World Cup would be, well, I don't think there is any sporting event. You know, you might argue.
It would be like a Stanley Cup for people in Mexico, for example, right?
Yeah, but it's worldwide.
It's
beyond the Stanley Cup. Like
people
tenfold.
Know in Cambodia, yeah.
What I didn't realize that we were at that level. Like that you could end somehow a Canadian team could end up in the World Cup. I didn't think we had that.
Well, funny you say that, Dan, because traditionally we have not. And it's been a big question mark. How can a country that is so diverse, with so many people from so many lands, that soccer is their favorite sport, has Canada not progressed faster than it has when it comes to soccer? Mm-hmm. And then it gets, you know, questions of coaching and, you know, facilities and climate. But again, to get back at climate, this game last night, Mexico in Edmonton, a Commonwealth Stadium, it was -9 for the game.
Yeah, that's about right this time of year in Edmonton, having grown up there. So they're complaining about the weather.
Yeah. Well, this is it. You know, and I watched a bit of it last night. It was fascinating to watch, but the question was raised, is this fair to the Mexicans? Apparently, somehow Canada got to choose where this game was, or however the schedule comes down. I'm not going to sit here and pretend I know about the World Cup structure and qualifying. I just don't. All I know is the game ended up in Edmonton, and there were some questions about, is it fair to the Mexicans? And I laughed that off because, you know, is it fair when Team Canada, the Canadian soccer team, has to go and play in Mexico City up in the mountains?
Mm.
You know, and the air is thin and the heat is punishing. You know, Canadians have to play in Central America, where near the equator, where it's the heat is just so punishing. We're not used to it. Our players and, you know, our guys aren't used to it. So how is it any different? You know, it's the World Cup. It involves the world.
How soon is the World Cup going to be? Is this the one that's in Qatar or something?
Again, you're asking me questions.
No. Okay. Qatar next year.
Yeah, okay.
Next year? Or is it this year?
Yeah.
Oh, it's every 4 years, like a Olympics.
It's every 4 years.
So this is when, if they win enough games, they'll end up in Qatar.
Yes, this is it. But back to the weather, Dan.
Right. Yes. Which out west was pretty substantial.
Well, it's the World Cup.
Yeah.
And the thing is, which means the world. And the world has all sorts of weather patterns. And the world has all sorts of climates. And it just so happens Canada's climate at this time of the year is cold. So you come here and you play, and you deal with it. And that's exactly what happened last night. And Canada beat the Mexicans 2-1.
Is this where you say, bite me?
No.
Bite me.
No, this is the part when we discussed it before. I said 2-1, and you said, that's low for a soccer score, didn't you?
Yeah. We just before the show, like, I don't know enough about soccer, obviously.
Yeah, but you don't know that much?
No, well...
You thought that was low for a soccer score? Actually,
yeah, I thought,
that's
like, in the tens or something. What's the game is... How is it the game exciting if you're not scoring goals?
No, that I agree with. But, no... The point is, you thought that soccer had scores of like nines and tens?
Yeah. I've never actually watched a soccer game. I watch parts of soccer game. I never watched one from start to finish. I have no
idea.
Okay,
but you're 62 years old. Somewhere along the line, you never realized that soccer was a low-scoring game.
No.
Which is fine, I guess. I'm just surprised.
No interest. Even,
like, yeah. I'm a casual soccer guy, but I know that much.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know. Now I've added on to my sport knowledge, which...
Well, here's the bottom line with it, is that, again, Canada's in good shape to qualify for the World Cup since the first time since maybe the 80s or early 90s.
I think it's like 1994. It's like a ridiculous year like that, yeah.
Yeah, which is weird when you see some of the other countries that qualify each World Cup, and it's left, you know, a lot of Canadians scratching their head. Like, if that country can make it, why can't we? But anyway, we're in good shape to get to the World Cup. Excuse me while I clear my throat.
All right. So basically you're saying that our teams have come right along. Or
yes.
We just better compete in cold environments because we do better that way, I guess. Right?
Uh-huh.
Do people think that was a valid win, or like normally in, you know, sort of non-winter conditions, would we have done okay?
Well, that's a good question. It actually is, but it's immaterial.
True.
It really is.
Yeah. To your
it
original point. Yeah, I get it.
Because Canadians often have to go and play in punishing conditions that we're not used to, and that's what happened to the Mexicans last night. So deal with it. Deal with it, and they did. Okay, the next step in weather is, you were a weatherman once.
Yeah. I worked in Peterborough at Chex, which was Global Peterborough. I worked there for a few years doing the weather there.
How long was that, Dad?
Like two and a half years, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So take us through, and I think people will find this fascinating, because I think we've all, over the years, had our favorite weatherman, weather person. You know, there was Dave DeBall, and way back, I'm dating myself, Percy Saltzman.
Wow.
At the CBC. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was Bill Lawrence at CBC. And as I say, Dave DeBall. And most recently, there was Tom Brown at CTV who got the boot last year. And that didn't bother me too much. I thought he was a little too frenetic. Did you ever see Tom Brown?
Yeah. He was very smiley. Very smiley. Very smiley, yeah. He's a very cheerful man.
He was making way too much money, so they put the boots to him.
Right.
As happens in broadcasting. But I think people would find that interesting. Run us, walk us through the day of a weatherman.
Well, when you're setting up, generally speaking, you're setting up the system, you're trying to figure out how to tell the weather story on the news package, whatever it is. So the first thing you do is sort of scan over the big picture of what the forecast is for the area you're talking about. What I would always do is do the, it was called Futurecast, which basically is a an animation of what the, there's different forecasting models, and I would go through all the ones and visually see them and how they would track across the continent and see where it was affecting us, and then decide what the stuff that I would be talking about would be, and then drill down more. And you had to learn how to use that weather program. It's pretty complicated. Top line, it's medium complicated, but if you want to do anything creative, you have to really, really know that program. Like any program,
Did it make you nervous, Dan?
At first, because I didn't know enough about weather. So that was,
know enough about weather. And the thing is, you're giving people the weather, so you want some degree of accuracy. How foolproof, like that program, how foolproof is the accuracy? Like, I can imagine the old days, the meteorologists, and you were never a meteorologist, right?
Right.
That takes education and schooling and stuff.
Yeah, stuff that I didn't have time for.
And like me, you don't have that.
No.
but seriously, so you come to work and it's like, you know, it's like when I was a sportscaster, I don't want to give the wrong score or make the wrong prediction. So here you are, you walk into work and you're thinking, you know, the city of Peterborough is depending on me.
Right.
To give them the goods,
like
when it comes
to
weather.
When you're in a situation that you know you're brand new to, you overcompensate by overanalyzing and really looking hard at, you know, trying to figure out what's going on. So I would spend a lot of time looking at, like I said, the different models, different forecast models, because I was worried about that. Always wondering whether the system that the station had was any better than, say, the weather networks or the, you know, Weather Underground or Environment Canada. Environment Canada supplies all those programs with data, but they all have different weather forecasting models, which, you know, rely slightly different on some things. And some of those programs are really, really accurate in certain ways, and other ways long term they're not. In fact, you know, it's interesting, I think I talked about this before, during the whole pandemic when the number of flights went down across big bodies of water, they lost a whole lot of data that they couldn't use, and so forecasting actually became less accurate during that time. And it's coming back. But yeah, they started having to throw up more weather balloons to compensate, because all these thousands of flights that were coming in daily that had weather data over the oceans and the high altitude weather from those aircrafts was all compiled into a large database. And that was sort of, you know, scuttled because of the lack of flights.
How much time would you spend on preparing for a weather forecast?
Probably 3 hours.
Get out.
2 to 3 hours, yeah.
Well, the weather could literally change during that time. Yeah. So a lot of it is, as they say, forecasting. Did you ever have to make a call on your own? Like, it looks like this, it might be that. I'm going to make a call myself. Or did you stay strict to Environment Canada or whatever those services would say?
No.
Did you ever stick your neck out, Dan?
Not really. But I did make educated guesses, because where I was in Peterborough, there's one or two stations of the Environment Canada runs in the Peterborough area. But that covers the whole area, all the way up to Bob Cajun and over to Lindsay. Like, there's a large area. So you know, it's like when you're saying, you know, the percentage of rain, it's likely it's going to be, well, in that whole area, the chance of rain in within the next 24 hours or that area. So there is probably a high percentage of chance that there will be rain in the area, but not necessarily right in one specific zone. So those kinds of things you kind of pointed out and took this on.
Then there's the whole other dimension of being a weatherman, and I witnessed this many times. the idea of standing in front of the camera. Now the weathercast has started.
Yeah.
Here you are on Czech Television Peterborough.
Right.
Where they never ever appreciated you to the degree they should have. They had this gem, Dan Duran, this wonderful man who was more than willing to go out in the community and shake hands, unlike so many other of the layabouts that work up there. Believe me, I was part of that environment.
Mm-hmm.
Those going out in the community and meeting people is something a lot of them don't want to do. Now, Dan Duran was willing to do that, and a fine, good-looking man, right?
Yeah.
Here you That's were their weatherman. You stand in front of the camera, and you got to, like, point in the opposite direction of what people are seeing, and, you know, and how all that works. Like, you're pointing at something on the screen, but looking down on a monitor. That can be very confusing, right, Dan?
Yeah, especially when you first started. Like, you know, when you're looking and you're doing your FaceTime, or you're doing, you know, your selfie with the phone, and you see yourself on the phone. That's yes. been mirrored. So you right. actually, it's easy because you can kind of, it looks like a mirror, right? When yes. when you're doing it on television, it really doesn't work if you mirror it. You're seeing the exact opposite. So if mm-hmm. you point left on the monitor, you're seeing yourself pointing right. So it's a little bit, this spatial kind of thing gets kind of weird because you just don't know how to, you know, point at first because it's all backwards. You get used to it, yeah. though.
Yeah, you get used to it. In the early days, I remember watching a couple of weather forecasts with you, and you got that mixed up a bit. And believe me, I found no joy in that, Dan. I thought I would hate to be in that position because not only are you, you know, you're on television for crying out loud.
Yeah.
And while you're on live television, like you got to do all this pointing and worry about all this pointing this way when it looks that way. And like, I yeah. get it. That could not have been easy.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, they did the time I was there. They made sure that I had as much equipment that I could possibly use to,
right.
to do that. There was monitors everywhere. There's a monitor on the left and the right, and the one right in the on the camera. And you know,
Did the powers that be ever call you in and say, Dan, you're pointing the wrong way, or you got to turn the wrong way, or you got to, they didn't, eh?
No, I mean, I think I tackled that pretty quickly, that part of the problem. They did, well, I was once called in and asked to tone it down a bit. They thought I was...
What do you mean?
That I was I don't know, somebody must have complained that I was having too much fun or joking around
what?
Or something too
much. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's another, yeah, I know.
So just, you know, tone it down a little bit, Dan. Okay.
Yeah. Believe me, I worked at the rock radio station in Peterborough, and nobody wanted to have fun there either. Believe me. It was interesting.
It was interesting.
Except for TJ Connors.
Yeah. Here's something interesting, though, that's happened over...
I want interest.
Here's something that's happened to television over time, and that was... I was in that space when they were transitioning. For global television, they run... like a master control room is where all the commercials are run, and they send all the commercials out to all the stations and stuff.
Right.
So when I say it used to be that a station would have its own master control, most of the global stations in Canada, now the master control is in Calgary. So all the programs are run out of Calgary in a big, huge room there. And the... Mm-hmm.
Job's gone
mm-hmm. all across Canada. Mm-hmm. And then the next phase is that they've wired all their studios to control rooms. Control rooms are also pretty expensive. So they, you know, where the director sits and all that. So they have control rooms in Toronto and a few other places across Canada. And they're running newscasts for, you know, each of these zones, so that when they were doing a newscast, there was a control room for that was running Halifax, and there was us. And then after our show's over, then they would reset and do the next region that had a morning show or whatever they're doing the news. Right. So, you know, from cascading to cascading. So one director would do one show. Mm-hmm. They'd reset for the next show, and then they'd do that next show. And all Crazy. The talking that, you know, that you hear in your ear, that's all coming out of Toronto.
Jobs lost.
That's exactly true,
But that's the way of the world. Now, in the next dimension...
Oh, and they had robotic cameras in all those places, by the way.
Of course, jobs lost.
Yeah.
Robotic cameras. It's sad. I mean, You just, you know, I mean, that whole sidebar to this, all the kids being trained at the colleges to be cameramen, and like, it's just sad. There's, where are the jobs? The next dimension, Dave Duvall told Howard and I this on a couple occasions when we had him on our show, that when he would be out and about, people would come up to him and almost sometimes be annoyed with him because they went on a holiday and the weather was bad, or he had predicted sunshine and it had rained. Did you ever suffer the wrath of the Peter Burns, who can be quite nasty at times? Did you run into that, like, when you were...
I didn't, again, it was never,
you know, like, you're a very identifiable guy. You're, you know, your good looks are striking. There you are in Peterborough. You've been on television for a while, and people walk up to you and say what?
It would be what is that? Something about it, you know, nice to have a job you don't have to be good at, or something like that. I've had that a couple of times. Some versions. It's nice to have a job you don't have to be good at. So you don't have to be accurate. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter if you're
right.
You can, you still have your job the next day.
Oh, I see what you're saying. But so, that's not the weather.
Well, there were, you know, compliment that I am misrepresenting whatever actually happened in the weather. Hey, you said there was going to be rain or something. Right. Well, nice to know that you don't have to, you know, be accurate. So that was thrown out there. But most people I ran into were friendly. There was a few of those kind of, you know, snide remarks that I would get once in a while about the weather. But
like, what, give us an example of a snide remark. I'm glad I wasn't there.
Well, just that, it's like, well, you know, hey, mm-hmm. You know, thanks for all this rain you didn't forecast, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, right? So it was never a long interaction, though. I never had any kind of people berating me.
All right, so they give you the boot.
Yep.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
What do they do now in Peterborough for weather? Do they have a weather guy? Because there was some guy named Graham somebody for years that did the weather there, and then there was this short guy that went to CBC. I forget what his name was. It checks, and they all moved on to other things. You were given the boot. You did not move on. And this is another thing that blows me away. How another outlet didn't pick you up to be their weatherman is just mind-boggling to me. Yeah.
Well, it's also the way of the world. I mean, there's a lot of people out there.
And you're an old guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm an old guy, and there's a lot
you're
of
people. You're an old white guy.
Somewhere in there, yeah. Don't qualify anymore. And there's a lot of, because of what you've been talking about, all these cutbacks in the industry, there's way more competition for jobs right now. So, you know, if losing a job, like, there's people all across Canada that are as qualified as I am to do the weather, I would guess. And, you know, there's lots of competition. Plus, there's fewer of those jobs. The job that I was doing was on the morning show, and what they decided, they reorganized the company, and they said that any morning shows that have weather people dedicated to that are out, and that was because we don't do that. So that's the reason. It was just a financial decision for the reason that they let me go. So the morning weather is done by is not a person in front of a screen necessarily. It's just the news anchor that does the morning that's doing that now.
They threw you right out onto George Street. Well, they're lost, Dan.
Yeah.
They're lost because, again, they don't know what they had in Dan Duran as far as a community leader, a community personality, a community contributor.
Well, thank you, Fred. I should have had you representing me there.
Yes, that would have been good. All right, we better stop down for some business now, as they say. Dan?
Yes?
What would you like to tell us about right now?
I'd like to talk about the pants that you wear and that Howard is wearing right now in your Venices, doing his venicing. It's Doer Pants, built with technical design features and tons of stretch, with street-ready styles and washes. Each pair supports a lifestyle of function and fashion. Howard's looking very fashionable there right now. From Netflix binges to weekend scrambles, the biggest pitches, and the coldest commutes, Doer has you covered early for Black Friday. Hey, that's coming up. Right around the corner, yes. American Thanksgiving, and then so that means that Black Friday is on the go. Starting November 21st, you can save up to 40% on the pants you'll never want to take off and that never go on sale. So this is one of those extremely rare times coming up. Go to doer.ca For more information, that's Duer, DUER.ca.
Very good. Chambers of Commerce Group Insurance Plan, Canada's number one group benefits plan for small business. You can get a free quote today. Go to chamberplan.ca. It's right there, a badge. Get a free quote. That's what it says. You put in the information about your business, the size of your business, what kind of benefits you're looking for, and they'll come back at you with something that you can live with. Believe us, all right? Whether it's prescriptions, it's dental insurance, it's the Teladoc system, which they have, all sorts of services. It'll blow your mind what you can be part of. 30,000 Canadian businesses are part of this. So, hey, there's strength in numbers. They've been around for 40 years. You can do it for your people. All sorts of testimonials there. Chamberplan.ca. I should also say, you know, I was remiss. You know, I'm relatively new to this driving the bus thing. Off the top, our guest today at 8:15. And look at, I'm giving the time check on a podcast.
Yeah.
No. Anyway, yeah. In a few minutes is Bruce Dobigan, who is a sportscaster at the CBC. People, you know, in the Southern Ontario region might remember, but he's a broadcaster. He's a writer. And we're going to be talking about a hockey book that he wrote with his kid and a few other things.
A kid's hockey book?
No, it's not a kid's hockey book, but he wrote it with his kid, which is, would be an experience in itself. I find that all warm and fuzzy. Can you imagine? No, think about it. Actually,
well, it's true, yeah.
You know, a project like that with your kid, it would be great.
If he's really into sports like his dad, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I won't be having a lot to say during that then, you don't think, because I'm not up on. I can't get deep into all the sports chat that's going on, because I have no real vested interest.
No, I get it. Yeah. So I'll give you a few more minutes here. And I alluded to this yesterday. And we'll do this before Bruce checks in.
Right.
You and I spend a lot of time together up at the trailer, the Tin Palace.
Yes, we do.
And for the most part, we get along. And I'd say we get along.
Yeah, we get along fine. There's moments that we, you know.
There's the odd time that, not so much the last couple of years, a bottle of scotch will come out, and then the debates and arguments start.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, no, we've had some heated discussions, you know.
Yes, we have, and then, and it's sort of political and sort of philosophical and environmental, all of them. So I'm just going to go through a few here, and we'll just throw out some of the contentious things between you and I.
Oh, right, okay.
Okay.
Sure.
And we'll give a quick response to what our positions are currently.
Right.
All right.
Okay.
Like the carbon tax.
Right.
Right. Like a lot like the World Cup, I don't fully understand the carbon tax. All I know is I don't trust it. I don't trust politicians. Where's that money going?
And that's what you've always said. Where's the money
going
to go?
Where's the money going? Because all these government programs that we're sucked into with tax dollars often end up in general revenue to support the sitting government.
Right.
So I tell you, I don't like the carbon tax from that standpoint.
Right.
You know, in its true, what's the term? You know, if it was orchestrated the way it should be, I might be all in, but I just don't trust it. Your response?
Well, I mean, where else are you going to go with it? I mean, I think the carbon tax is a good idea, and it's surprising that that a lot of people who are, you know, more on the capitalist side of things don't like it, because if you're going to affect a change, the market forces of the carbon tax would make sense, wouldn't it? Because you've created an environment where you can buy and sell the carbon tax credits, right? Yeah. So that if you are a bigger polluter, you can.
I guess.
So, but what in the end, it's costing more, and there's a way to save money,
right?
By you know, changing your ways so that there's less carbon out there, or encouraging others to do it by trading however the system is specifically set up.
Well, I know, but the way it's filtered down, it's just added. I mean, we're all under this you know, and that's a whole other thing. Talking to my kids last night, you know, inflation has taken off and the price of things right now, I don't feel as feel it as much as they do. And they brought up again the price of gas, which is tied directly to the carbon tax. And it's just a lot for people to swallow at this point. And as much as they love the environment, they don't fully understand what it's all about. And it gets back to what I said, trust. It's fine if the money was going to help the problem. Super. I don't believe it. It will.
Well, that may be a hard thing to actually assure you that it will. But I mean, I think there's rules and regulations that, you know, determine how all this should come out. I mean, you know, there's probably better ways of doing it in certain other, you know, jurisdictions than others. But I don't know if I entirely agree with your premise that it's all the carbon tax, that the gas price is
high.
I didn't
say it was all carbon tax. Because it contributes.
The whole inflation thing is all part of, you know, getting back from the pandemic and all the shortages supply chain and stuff, right?
I did not say is all carbon tax. I said it's part of it.
Oh, okay.
And there really is a filter down or trickle down. And I hate that term, believe me.
Well, how
carbon tax. Okay.
Okay. Well, I was just going to ask you, how do you think the government can do it so in a way that you would trust it?
I don't know, Dan. I just don't trust that one. Oh. And that's a conversation for another time. I think it's more the individual. We all have to do more individually at the grassroots level before the government comes to, you know, leaning on us.
Yeah.
But again, that's a conversation. Let's move on to the next thing.
Okay.
The 407. Oh.
Yes.
The 407 I love. It's very expensive, but the reason it's expensive, that keeps it, that's how they maintain it as a luxury.
Right.
If it's expensive, it thins out the traffic, which means it's worth it to a lot of people. Again, I hate the fact from the 410 to the 115, you know, in prime time, it can cost $50. But it's like, you know, I get to that point and I think, is it worth $50 to me not to sit on the 401 for the next 2.5 hours heading for Peterborough? So I'm all in on the 407. I understand why it's expensive. All you do is bitch and complain about it, and you'd like it to be free or like 50 cents a trip or something.
Yeah.
Respond.
Well, because all the taxpayers of Ontario have contributed to the 407, and it's now become this very, very expensive piece of land that you have to, you know, like, what is it, like $50 to go across the top to say the airport from one end to the other. That's what it.
But if you time it,
well, sometimes you can't do
it. It can be half that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, but you can't. But that, I mean, that's traveling after 7 or before 7 in the morning or something, or on weekends. I mean, that's not
right.
Not necessarily achievable. And I understand that it's traffic flow that's why the prices go up. And maybe as a sidebar, maybe that traffic should be more. Like there should be segmented more rather than just a blanket 7 to 7 or whatever the prices are, that it's down to the hour. So if it's
it is, there's midday and all that,
right?
But as it all gets back to this, and where I've pushed back on you with the 407 is you have used the words, oh, it's a rich man's highway.
Yeah, well, obviously it is, because
I'm not a rich man, number one. Number two, what's wrong with having, if I was a rich person, what's wrong with having some things for rich people? What is wrong with that? They built this highway, and the idea to keep it thin and take the excess off the main arteries, people that can afford it can use it. What's wrong with that? You know, they have stuff for poor people. Why can't they have stuff for rich people?
Okay. Well, because we all paid for it. I mean, it's like it's the privilege to have a lot of privileges anyway. So now we're going to give you extra privileges to travel along these highways. I don't agree with that. I think that, and the Ford government's talking about fast tracking. There's two big, there's some bypass that's going out near Guelph or something
Bradford.
Like that. Yeah. And then there's that one that they're fast tracking. And there's another one that's going through the escarpment somewhere that what's the extension of the 407 or the
413.
Yeah.
It's like north of Wonderland.
Yeah.
And then it goes straight down to the 407 split with 401.
Right. And those are going to be toll highways again. So now we're taking up bunches of farmland.
No, they're not. They're not going to be toll highways. No.
Are you sure?
Yeah. But anyway, that's besides the point.
All right.
But they're, you know, we need highways. So highways need to be built because there's no subways up there.
Yeah. I would agree.
The public, you know, it's why our subway system sucks in Toronto. And it's why our infrastructure, why we're so gridlocked near the top of the list, is because whenever it comes to building this stuff, we drag our feet, we second guess, we listen to the environmentalists, which we should to a degree, but nothing ever gets done. And it's as the GTA grows, what comes with that is some roads and some highways. You got to do it.
I agree.
And it's the same old thing. The people that live near it don't want it. I get that. And then the people that need it want it. And then the fight begins.
Right. And there's a lot of delay tactics that are used by people, which probably shouldn't. I mean, obviously, in a broad bureaucracy, it gets a little bit messy. With any government, it's going to be that way. However, you know, I agree with you that if there's environmental surveys and studies and assessments that have to be done, that they should be done in a timely way, and it shouldn't be put off and put off and put off.
Uh-huh. Okay, next one.
Okay.
And quickly on this one, park fees, trailer park fees. You and I are at odds constantly over this. I just find it ironic, a voice artist like you, who would go into any session expecting, wanting to make as much money as they could, the highest scale possible, has a problem with other levels of business wanting to make money too. I just find that ironic, a little hypocritical. And you and I, you know, they raise the park fees and, you know, there's a lot of bitching and complaining. But at the end of the day, it's not really a democracy and it's not under the Landlord-Tenant Act. And these guys that own the park are actually in the business to make money.
Right.
So at the end of the day, it's like, I'm going to pay it or I'm not. I'm going to pay it. Right?
Right.
Or I'm going to leave.
Yeah.
What I can't sort of get my head around or swallow or put up with is the bitching and complaining after the fact. It's like, it is what it is. You pay it or you don't. Uh-huh. So, Dad?
Right. Well, I mean, I agree with all of that to a point. But the seasonal trailer parks, where they've gotten to the point where the units that they're putting on them are so very expensive that it becomes a little bit, you know,
a rich man's game, Dan. Right.
Back to that. Yeah. But if you have the Landlord-Tenant Act has a lot of rules and regulations because there's been shitty landlords out there doing horrible things to people. Not that I'm saying that our park is like that, but there's really no protections for anybody in there because it's seasonal. You can be, you know, out the next year for whatever reason after you've, you know, put all your sweat equity and whatever into your little slice of leased land there for 1 year. My point being mostly is that where we are, it's been a community. Like, we've been up there, what, 20, 25 years or something like that? So there's a community of people, you know, and that we have, you know, grown up around. And sometimes the capitalism of things kind of changes the dynamics of community and the community aspect of it is really important to our society. And so, like, it's kind of ruining it. That's my
point. I know it's that whole capitalist thing too. It's bad unless it's in my pocket. Then it's okay. Then it's okay.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. There's probably Well,
tell me, is Bruce Dobigan standing by at all at this point?
Oh yes. You know what? Learning how to run things.
Okay, I understand.
You're right. Bruce, there's a little bar there that I never see.
Bruce Dobigan is the Gig Sky guest of the day. Dan, why don't you tell us about what's up with Gig Sky, and then I'll introduce Bruce Dobigan, and we'll take it from there.
Well, Howard has taken his Gig Sky account on the road. There's when you're doing international travel, there's one of those things when you're thinking about is data plans all the time. Well, Gig Sky has data travel plans for you to take care of whatever you need to do. If you're in the tropics, you're heading to Europe, or you're just plan to make your way south, you'll need mobile data to keep you
connected. Hold on a sec, Dan. We're losing this. Hey, Dobigan, we can hear your dog barking or somebody yelling.
So my grandkids are here all of a sudden.
Oh,
I'm in Fredericton with my grandkids, and right now my grandson is going through my golf bag and taking all the golf balls
out. Okay, that's cool. I love that. That's
well,
real.
There's no snow on the ground here. I suppose we could play here if we had to. Anyhow, they're leaving now.
Okay, just hold on a sec. Dan Durant's going to read a spot here, and then we'll get to you.
Okay.
Okay, buddy.
You can download the Gig Sky app from, for your Android or iOS and get affordable data coverage for over 190 countries worldwide. And I've done some traveling over the summer, and one of the things that you can do on a lot of flights now is pay for data, and you can, you know, do your emails while you're on the plane. It's very expensive, and GigSky's latest service offering includes mobile data while you're flying, so you may want to check that out. While traveling on selected airlines and routes, you can get mobile data, so go to gigsky.com/aeromobile to see the full list of airline partners, or just to find out more, go to gigsky.com.
Thank you, Dan Duran. Can we see you, Bruce? Can you...
Sure, hang on a second. I didn't know I was going to be on with the video, but I'll put the video on. If you can stand it, I can stand it. There we go. Hang on.
Okay. Okay, here's your big intro, okay?
All right.
Bruce Dobigan is a best-selling author of over 10 books and a two-time winner of the Gemini Award as Canada's top television sports broadcaster. Dobigan has worked as a journalist for the Calgary Herald, the Globe and Mail, and as a broadcaster for CBC News World, and has recently written a hockey book with his son, Evan. Which, again, I was saying a few minutes ago, is pretty cool. We're going to get to the book in a few minutes, but pretty cool to work with your son on a project like that, I'm sure.
Yeah, he grew up around sports, obviously, with me. He had met people, and he'd go to games, and we're always talking sports at home. And he's a bit of a Rain Man, statistics and all that sort of stuff. And cool. My secret is he's been my research guy all these years. So when I was working on the books, this is 10 books I'm up to now, I'd research the books. And I'd say, Evan, what was the year that Don Cherry won the Coach of the Year? Was that 77? No, that was 78, and he finished second by 10 points, whatever it was. He was never wrong. So he was really sort of reliable. Anyhow, he parlayed that into a job. He's at TSN. He runs their Stats Center Twitter site. He does statistics and boards for them, etc. And so we've been sort of headed towards this for a few years and figuring a project to work on, and this was the one.
You know, I was a sportscaster most of my professional career, and my son loves to play sports, but he's not at all interested in watching or statistics or anything like that. That's how it unfolded for us. And again, he loves golf and all that, but he's just not interested in sitting and watching games.
My younger son, Reese, who I'm visiting here in New Brunswick, did sports management, and he for 4 years worked for the Calgary Stampeders, and he got his fill of sports, and now he works in other industries and stuff like that. And you know the way it is, Fred, all these kids who want to get into the business, I always say to them, you want to be a sports journalist? Oh, yeah. Well, why? I love sports. And I said, well, you know, it's the second part that's the most important part, the journalist part.
Yeah.
Because within 10 minutes, you'll be disappointed in the sports part because all the athletes and people you meet, you know, they don't need you, and they act accordingly. And if you're not into the journalism part of it, you'll never survive.
To that point, Bruce, can I just quickly ask, you said you've written 10 books now?
This is up to 10, yeah. 10? 9 of them are sports books. And the one I did just previous to that, I did a book called Personal Account with Tony Comper, who was the CEO of the Bank of Montreal for 10 years. And it just got nominated for the Business Book of the Year. So we're very pleased with that.
How did you decide that you wanted to start writing books? That's a pretty big decision, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, I was like Fred. I was an electronic guy doing radio and TV, and somebody came to me about doing a book, and I thought, when am I going to get the time to do it, et cetera?
Right.
And I started work in the early 90s on the story about about Allen Eagleson. And I found at a certain point, I just had so much material that we'd accumulated in doing that, none of which I could get on the air, that it seemed natural to me, okay, let's at least get a book project so I didn't waste my time assembling all this information. So that's what happened. And that was the first book. It was called Defense Never Rests. And it was the four defensemen for the Leafs in the 60s, Bonds, Brewer, Stanley, and Horton. It was about them and their fight for their pension and getting Allen Eagleson and all that. That started me like 8 years of working on the Allen Eagleson story.
Well, you always sort of presented yourself or were somewhat referred to as the thinking man sportscaster back in the day. right, Bruce?
Yeah, no, that was my. I always the story was that I was doing radio, and the TV guy at CBC in Toronto, he said he hired me because they used to listen to the radio show coming in, and his wife. I was the first sportscaster his wife listened to, and he said, "Okay, I want the women's demographic to listen to sports. She's listening to this guy. Let's go get that guy." So I don't know.
You know what? I went through the same thing at CFNY. Again, a music radio station.
Yeah.
And the way I presented the sports, they liked it because, you know, the attitude was, be it female or guys that were really into music, maybe not so much into sports, the way I presented it sort of drew them in. So I can relate to that.
Yeah, you did. That was your moniker. Yeah. That was your reputation in the biz.
Speaking of which, let's clear this up. I think the year was 1988.
Yes.
1988, I get a call from the CBC. It was Lorna Borley and Doug Sirota.
Yeah.
And they said that they had this idea for a show. Now, this was CBC Entertainment.
Yeah.
And it was a sports show. Would I be interested in co-hosting this sports show? Mm-hmm. It was sort of cutting edge. It would be a couple of armchairs, and we wouldn't be in suits, and we'd sit and just have fun with sports every Sunday night.
Yeah.
At 11:30. So I said, yeah, I'm into it, because it was different and I liked it. Now, you're aware of this, are you not?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was early on. I've been doing sports for 3 years, and then we found out that they were going to put a sports show on after us. And yes. My first thing was, well, why aren't they asking me? I'm the sports guy for the station, and I'd like to sit in a comfy chair and talk about sports. Anyhow, it's all about turf.
No, I get it. That show was actually ahead of its time, because it wasn't long before you started seeing a lot of informal sports shows with guys.
I was going to say, yeah, you guys were ahead of the curve. It was you and BJ Del Conte, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and you were sitting in armchairs. People today look at that, oh, well, that's nothing. Everybody does that. But you guys, mm-hmm. That was entirely different. And that sort of also bugged me, because I wanted to try to do things that were entirely different too, and sort of push the boundaries. And we later on, we did, I think, the first TV show, sports TV show, in which we interacted with people on the phone on TV, on Newsworld, a national show, for a couple of years. And that's what I wanted to do. And I was just jealous of you. I just said, why is this guy getting the chair, the comfy chair on Sunday night?
But see, we never crossed paths. And, yeah. And we had heard that there was some tension, because, again, this was CBC Entertainment, and CBC Sports was a little upset. But a couple of times, because you didn't do sports on Sunday night, it was Don Martin.
Yeah.
And Don made, no bones about it. Like, he was not very friendly towards us.
Well,
like,
if it's any consolation, Don was not friendly towards many people.
Oh,
he was,
okay.
He made my life pretty miserable for a few years as well. He was not happy. He thought he should have had the 6 o'clock show. I got the 6 o'clock show, and he just dismissed me for years after that. And he went off to Global, and he was very, I'm not going to slag the guy, but he was not an easy guy to work with. One of the most talented people on air that I've ever met. He and Ron McLean are the most talented technical people on sets that I've ever seen. But yeah, he was hard to work with.
Yeah, because it was weird, because, like, I was so excited about doing this show, and I was excited to be in that environment. And I was excited when I first saw Don Martin, because I thought, hey, that's the guy I see, see on TV. And I think the first encounter was in a washroom, actually, and he walked in. I said, hey Don, how are you? He looked at me and he said, the intruder, and walked out.
Wow, that's pretty
He was very cold. He could be very cold.
I remember once
he and I had played golf once, and I don't know, I'd hit a bad shot and chucked my club aside. And then one day I was watching a PGA event. I was commenting on it on air. And I said, hey, those guys have got to control themselves. And that night on the show, he said, well, certain sportscasters are complaining about guys who can't control their temper when they can't control theirs either. Oh, yeah. The shot was there. But yeah, I'm not surprised at all that he treated you that way.
Whatever happened.
It was a turf war, and people were very jealous of their turf. And I was, I had just started, and this idea that these other two people who had an office in the back of the back of the back, that they would come up with the show and get airtime that we wanted. So, anyhow.
You know what the best part of that show was for me? And then we'll move on. They asked me to do the show, and I think they offered me like $350 a show, and I held out for $500. I did.
Good
I got
man.
I got $500 a show, yeah. And then a few weeks into it, they started rerunning it in the morning or something.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the pay stubs are like, I'm getting 50% more than the $500, and I'm thinking, like, why is that? And that's when I was introduced to the wonder of television and how the union works and everything. That rerun was making me money while I was doing the sports at CFNY. I was still getting paid at the CBC. It was great because they'd have it on in the on the TV in CFNY, and there would be me and BJ doing the show while I'm doing a sportscast on the radio, and I was making money in both seats. It was great.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Yeah,
well,
TV's where the money is. What's that old line they asked the bank robber about? Why does he rob banks? He said, that's where the money is. And I don't know about you, but every day of the week, I'd prefer to do radio. I like radio. Oh, yeah. I still think radio is the best combination of print and TV. So, but that's where the money is, and it draws you. And if it's any consolation, for a few years, they had me as the host of the Caravana Parade. One of the whitest people you can possibly imagine. I was the host of the Caravana Parade. So they did oddball things from time to time. And, listen, you guys did something and you kind of cut against the grain. And I think it was worth doing. And, I have no idea what – and it wasn't CBC Sports either. It was the local CBC people that were most aggrieved that you guys got that, because we didn't get that many slots and you had gotten one.
Right.
I just wanted to go back a point you made earlier about being a technical sportscaster, really, like the greatest you'd seen was Don McLean. What do you actually mean by that? I was kind of curious. Like what are the skills that you're
Well, as a broadcaster, I mean, when you're doing radio and things are going badly, typically the audience doesn't see your face, when the panic is on, you can be making all sorts of faces and gesturing to your producer, whatever. When I went to TV, all of a sudden I felt like I was in a cage. I couldn't do anything. And things went sideways. You can't stop the broadcast and say, oh, re-rack that or do this. And they're always talking in your ear, even as you're talking. The ability to look smooth and conversational. Ron McLean is fantastic at doing that. Certainly Don was too. Just really smooth. You could never see where the bumps were. With an inexperienced or bad broadcast, you can see exactly where the parts where the two sections joined together. It's like boom. But the good guys, they smooth it out, and they hear the producers, and they know how to get from in and out of commercials. They never run their guests into the end of a segment where he's halfway through an answer. Oh, sorry, we got to go. Just really, 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 really slick.
Okay, let's talk about the book. It's called Inexact Science, and it's about great stories from the NHL draft. Mm-hmm. And this stuff fascinates me as well. Because, be it hockey, be it baseball, I'll talk about baseball right off the top. I mean, the Oakland A's, but even more so the Tampa Bay Rays. It's drafting is everything. It's having the staff to recognize talent and acquire it. And some teams nail it and other teams just don't. Now, your book's about the NHL and specific stories. How many stories? What are the biggest stories?
Well,
in the
we
book?
Picked 6 years. We decided we couldn't cover it's too big a subject to cover and try to do a soup to nuts. So we chose 6 years we thought were significant, and to explain why they were significant. And I've covered these in a few of my books. I did a book on money players about the business of sport of hockey, and there's a lot of draft stuff in it. And I have to say that my best sources in hockey for hockey reporting were agents. And and so that always took me over to that side of it, the drafting, the business side. So anyhow, I'd always come at it from that point of view. I found it fascinating. And we chose 6 years. And the first one is 1971. That's the year that Sammy Pollock teaches the world about how important the draft is with the Canadians. He drafts Guy Lafleur. Could have had Marcel Dion as the number two pick. They could have had both guys.
Mm-hmm.
But at the last minute, the Canadians basically let the Red Wings take Marcel Dion. But it was the year in which people understood the value of the draft that we know it today. One of the other chapters is about Wayne Gretzky. I always call him a draft dodger because, of course, Wayne never was drafted. People say, well, how did the greatest player ever certainly the greatest offensive player ever, not get drafted. Well, that happened because he was 18. He was in the WHA at a time when the NHL, you couldn't play till you were 20. And the owner of the Edmonton Oilers signed Wayne to a personal services contract and said to the NHL, you're going to have a merger at the end of the year, WHA-NHL come together. And if you want Wayne Gretzky to play in your league, you have to deal with me because I have him on a personal services contract. And so that's how the Edmonton Oilers got into the NHL. And that's how Wayne Gretzky avoided the draft. He didn't have to go into the draft. He was retained by the Oilers as a condition of it. Anyway, it's stories like that of the 6 years. And they just fascinated us. And again, my son is about details, and there's lots of details.
And further to that, too, because often people, because they grew up with a draft, thought Bobby Orr was drafted by the Boston Bruins. Same thing. That was before the draft even existed. He was Boston Bruin property.
Property, yeah. He was signed to a C form when he was 12 or 13. And yes, that's how it worked in the past. And the Montreal Canadiens, of course, they were famous for that. The Canadiens' top farm team in many seasons could have been, you know, in the top 10 of the NHL standings itself. They had that much talent stowed away in various places. Mm-hmm. And then Sam Pollock, as I say in the earlier chapters, Sam understood how to take a middle-ranked prospect in the Canadiens, put him in a Canadiens uniform to make him look good, and then flip him to one of these other teams in exchange for draft picks. And, of course, the famous story was that he obtained the first pick overall from the Oakland Seals in a deal that was nobody. Mm-hmm. They got nobody. Oakland got nobody, and they traded the first round pick that turned out to be one of the greatest players of all time.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned the Tampa Bay Rays and Oakland A's because those are low budget teams which always seem to be competitive. Mm. And there's no other explanation other than identifying young talent. Now, there's some examples
of it and developing
and
it.
And developing. Oh, key.
That's very important.
And that's why I've always felt I've been frustrated by the Blue Jays because they had a lot more resources. Why couldn't that be you? Mm. I often think about the Blue Jays, although it's getting better. And there's examples in the NHL as well, like the Pittsburgh Penguins, Stanley Cup, and then they fall, and then Stanley Cup, and then they fall. You've got to admire that.
Well, we have two chapters in the book about Pittsburgh Penguin drafts, the Mario draft in 84, which right. literally saves the franchise from moving out of Pittsburgh. And then 2005, after all their cups with Mario and Jagr, they had mm-hmm. fallen into the pits again. And there was talk again that the Penguins might leave town. And they win the lottery in 2005 and get Sid Crosby.
And then Detroit Red Wings, same thing. I mean, like the Maple Leafs. Just brutal for years and years and year. Then they get their act together, and it produces three Stanley Cups, was it?
They won four Stanley Cups.
And they were
the best team in the league, or I would say the best organization in the league for 25 years. And our chapter on the 1989 draft goes into detail about what the Red Wings did. They were the first ones to really crack the European market big time because they drafted Russians who actually came to play in the NHL. They had that one draft in 1989. Their first two draft picks were just, you know, guys, regular guys. Bob Bugner, I think, was one of them. I forget who the second one was. But in the third round, they got Nick Lidstrom, who is arguably, he and Bobby Orr, one, two, the best defensemen of all time. Mm-hmm. They got Sergei Fedorov, and they got Vladimir Konstantinov, who was going to be a great defenseman, then was injured in a car crash. And in the 12th round, or the 10th round, rather, they were going to take Pavel Bure as well. Mm-hmm. And we tell in the book about why they passed on that. So you can imagine getting that haul of those guys and bringing them in. Because you remember, Fred, the whole thing was Russians won't play in the big right. games. They take their check. You don't make the same money in the playoffs, et cetera. Well, Scotty Bowman and Jimmy Devolano and Ken Holland and those guys realized that that Russian players in the right environment can win the Stanley Cup, and they did.
Absolutely.
So, can I ask you a question there, Bruce? Do you have a favorite team?
I grew up as a Gordie Howe fan. I grew up in Montreal, but I was a Red Wing fan, which meant that I got into fights every recess, mm-hmm. Which might sort of account for my personality these days. But anyhow, that they were my team. And by the time they hit the 89 draft and they did that, I was working in the business. And I sort of was so embittered by the Red Wings and hoping they would do something. So by the time they finally became the greatest organization, it wasn't the payoff I thought it was going to be, you know. Mm-hmm. For the Blue Jays, when they won the two World Series, it was a payoff for a lot of development stuff for people. Everyone felt great about it. By the time the Red Wings became the greatest franchise in the league for a quarter century, I was kind of put aside. And again, I'm sure Fred would tell you this, is that when you get into the business, you end up rooting for stories. You can't root for teams, and you can't root for your boyhood heroes or whatever it is. You got to root for stories, because that's what works. That's what brings you back to the table every time.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that I was able to shake. I've told the story. Me and Ted Wallace got in trouble at the 83 Grey Cup in Vancouver for cheering when the Argos. We were in the press box.
Oh, yeah, that would have got you in trouble.
And I
would have got you in trouble. No, I would have yelled at you, too.
Yeah.
That was supposed to be the no cheering in the press box. Yeah.
Oh, no, absolutely. Right. And I forget who it was, Cedric Minter, whoever got that touchdown. We, exploded in the press box. Oh, we were told right away. Yeah. And, you know, and I'm still, I'm a little mad at the Toronto Maple Leafs. And on that point, when it comes to the draft, it's just... Yeah. It's just another highlight of their half century of incompetence, is it not?
Yeah. We tell the story of how they could have lost Eric Lindros. In the end, they didn't have the top pick overall. It wasn't their pick that selected Lindros. The Quebec Nordiques obviously selected him. But they could have had Scott Niedermayer. And the irony in that whole sequence, you remember the Doug Carpenter days? They had that 1 year, I think it's 89-90 or 88-89, and they had a good year. And all the young guys scored, and they said, we just need a puck-moving defenseman. And so, of course, they went and they made the trade for, Tom Kervers from the Devils. Mm-hmm. And it just never worked out. The team fell apart yet again. And they finished, I think they had the third draft pick that year because they were so terrible. But that whole winter, you can remember, Fred, everybody was saying, oh, my goodness, if the Leafs finish last, we're going to have to watch somebody else draft Eric Lindros.
Yeah.
And they avoided that. But Scott Niedermayer would have been just as good as Eric Lindros for the Toronto Maple Leaf franchise, and they blew it. And a lot of that was Harold Ballard and the dysfunction. One of the things I always said about Toronto, I haven't lived there for a fair bit of time now, but I always said the most of the Toronto sports teams, their problem was that they do management by sports talk radio. Bob McCown could say something, and 2 days later, the owners are all upset. And what, you know, the Toronto Star would write something, and they'd have, oh, God, panic, panic, panic. They couldn't stay the course to do stuff. And that was the thing with a lot of the Toronto franchises.
In your research, too, isn't there a story about the Connor McDavid, the lottery night, where that was close, like a card stuck together, or the last ball in the machine, the bingo ball, apparently it was the Leaf one stuck there and then fell, and then the Edmonton one got sucked up, or is that just bullshit?
There's some urban myths about it. I mean, the Leafs ping pong ball could have been close, but as they say, only in horseshoes and hand grenades, right? Being close. And the Oilers got all the luck. I mean, you know, and they've done nothing with it. That's the frustrating part.
Yeah.
Is that the Oilers have had first round pick overall so many times, and done nothing with it. They're still trying to figure out how to win now.
Can I just interrupt here? I don't know a lot about this kind of thing. What are you talking about with ping pong balls? Is it like bingo?
When they do the lottery. In 2005, we'd had the lockout year. So no hockey for a year. And then in 2005, when they did the draft, they had no record to go by. You couldn't say, okay, they finished last, and that's how you did it. So they basically took all 30 teams in the NHL, put their names on a ping pong ball, put it into the hopper, and it popped up, and the name would come down, and the last one to be drawn was the one who got Sidney Crosby, and it turned out to be the Penguins. But as Fred said, people in Toronto are convinced that their ball was the one that was supposed to be chosen. But why the NHL wants McDavid in Edmonton, a city that's just, the team never wins, he never plays in the postseason. No. He needs to go to Toronto, he needs to go to New York, he needs to go to L.A.
And if the Leafs had got Connor McDavid and Auston Matthews, they couldn't pay them both anyway. I mean,
listen, I fought long and hard the battle against salary caps. I said it's bad for hockey. It will be bad, especially for a city like Toronto. And it's proven to be that way.
Okay, the book is Inexact Science. Where can people get it? Anywhere? Online?
Online.
You selling it? Yeah.
Indigo, Amazon. You can go on my website, brucedobiganbooks.ca. All of my books are available there. You can look on there, and there's links to where you can pick them up. And but I always say that if you have a local bookstore, a local bookseller in your neighborhood, please give them the business if you can. Go in and order 100 copies and tell them, oh, everybody I know is going to buy one. But frequent your local guys because they need the support.
You also have a website called Not the Public Broadcaster. That yes. is still active.
Oh, yeah, no. Twice a week. I do columns twice a week. We stir it up a little bit. We do a sports column, and we do a sort of a culture politics column later in the week.
I know. I was through speaking to Mike Boone. He said from moving to Toronto, your politics changed a bit. Not to get too heavy into that, but I'll raise the issue of Aaron Rodgers. Mm. We beat up on him pretty good last week. You have a different perspective on that?
No. I had two takes on it. One of which is that I felt he was disingenuous. If that's how you feel, tell everybody. I mean, Kyrie Irving and a bunch of NBA guys came forward and Andrew Wiggins came forward and they said, hey, this is how I feel about taking the thing. I respect somebody's opinion. I'm not one of these people who thinks that we should have mandates, etc. But anyhow, I respect his opinion. I thought Rodgers tried to have it both ways. But the secondary thing is I think he's entitled to his opinion. He's entitled to not get vaccinated if he wants to and to choose an alternative way of treating himself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's his right. And I'm just totally opposed to mandates, especially for things that clearly the virus that the vaccines we've got now, they're now admitting that they don't work quite the way they thought they were going to. And we've got to take a third and a booster and this, et cetera. So, again, I felt Rodgers tried to have it both ways. And, and I respect somebody for having an opinion.
Well, the Joe Rogan twist was a bit odd.
Because Rogan had talked about he had COVID, and he talked about going through his research and things he'd found out about treatments and, pre-treatments and things like that. And, Rogan's the most listened to guy on the internet. And he called him up and said, well, what did you find out? And then, of course, it came to, oh, he went to him for consulting as if he was a doctor. No, he said, what did you find out? I mean, it's an interesting thing about Rogers. He's kind of like Colin Kaepernick. They both got involved with women who sort of politicized them. Kaepernick got involved with a woman who moved him into the BLM circle. Well, in the case of Rogers, he's with this actress, Shailene Woodley, I think is her name.
Right.
Yeah, she's a holistic naturalist person. She takes no stuff. And that, so Rogers is now that guy. And that's
well,
what we're
yeah, she said she makes her own medicine.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all the way you present stuff. I just think he sounded a bit foolish through that.
Because he tried to have it both ways.
Like, yeah.
You know, we, in the public realm, I don't mind you having an opinion. I may not agree with it. I'm totally against the censorship that's going on in our business now. I'm totally against people I think you see these things on YouTube being canceled because somebody is trying to say, well, there might be something else. And they may be wrong. They may be, they may be having a bad idea. But our society is predicated on free speech.
So you're in Fredericton this morning, but you live in Calgary.
Yeah, I've been there for 22 years now.
Yeah.
23, actually.
So what's it like out there with COVID now? Like, wasn't there a big blow up or what's
well, I mean, the virus peaks in different places and it spikes and it goes around. I mean, I always say the virus is going to do what the virus is going to do. And it doesn't matter whether you vote conservative, NDP or liberal. It's going to get you. And how you respond to it is your own business. Calgary and Alberta they've had a relatively tough time with it. Excuse me. It's basically going to cost the premier his job. He's a conservative in Alberta, which should be the most secure seat in the country. But it's going to cost him his job because my feeling is that if you're going to take a position, take a position and be consistent with it. The guy I always point to is Ron DeSantis in Florida. Do you agree with him or don't agree with him? Whatever. But he's consistent. This is what he's believed the whole time. And I think a lot of our politicians have gotten in trouble because they're flipping flop. Oh, there's a column in the paper says this, or this health person says that. And, they're back and forth. You just stick with a narrative and go with it, right?
No, I get it. On the question of mandates, as I maintain in Canada, no one is being forced to get the vaccine. You, if you don't want to get the vaccine, you don't have to get the vaccine. But then the word mandate pops up. If you want to keep your job,
yes,
in this particular situation, you have to get the vaccine. See, I don't really have a problem with that.
I look at that. I know people in the healthcare industry who last year, 2020, were heroes on the front lines,
right,
fighting COVID, doing all that sort of stuff, who had an intimate experience of COVID and who know more about it than I do firsthand, and who looked at it and said, I'm not taking the vaccine. I'm going like, well, what do they know that I don't know? Mm-hmm. So I respect their decision to do that. And now they're losing their jobs because they won't do that. And I think that, again, that's unfair.
Yeah.
Hero one day, the next day, because of the vaccines, whoops, and not taking the vaccine. Now you're out in the street after 20 years or 30 years in the biz, right?
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, are you vaccinated?
Yep. Double-vaxxed, yep. Yeah. Well, my feeling about somebody at my age, and I'm 67 now.
Right.
Everything in the evidence said people like us are at most at risk. And so I've got to take anything I can to help me. But in terms of my son and my grandchildren, I'm not forcing them to take anything. I certainly don't want my grandkids to take it. Because
not yet, anyway.
No. Yeah. I don't think the vaccine that they've got is I think the risk of things happening from the vaccine is probably greater than the risk of COVID for a kid who's my grandkid's age, who's 4 or 5 years old. So, yeah, that's how I feel about people under 50. This has never been a pandemic of people under 50. This has been 50 and older. So, again, that's why I took the double thing. And my brother's picking me up tomorrow. We're driving to Florida. And to drive to get across the border, I got to be vaccinated twice. So I'm
Same here. I'm going to South Carolina tomorrow.
Oh, where are you going?
Myrtle Beach, north of Myrtle Beach.
Oh, yeah, good. Nice
do
place,
a little golfing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll be driving through there. I'll wave when I go through there because we're driving right by Myrtle Beach.
Well, you do that. Bruce Dobigan, thank you very much for being part of the show today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on. It's always good to talk to people who we knew from the day and are a certain generation of broadcasters.
Mm-hmm.
It's always fun. And yeah, if people get a chance to pick up the book, please do. And we're working on another one with my son, too. So we'll haunt you again.
It's Inexact Science. You can get the book online. And Not Your Public Broadcaster is your website, which I encourage people to go and read. You know, it's funny when it comes to COVID and when it comes to politics, we're all, you know, we're in an era where everybody gets their backs up. But, you know, if your argument is presented logically and calmly and again, with some thought, as you say, you have to respect other people's opinions.
Well, I mentioned the Eagleson stuff. In the early days of the Eagleson stuff, nobody wanted to hear it. He was a Canadian hero. And who was I? I was just some schlub on the TV. And that's the fact that that story came out as a triumph for our society and free speech. And well, what does he have to say? Can he back it up? Can he justify it? And that's all I'm saying about free speech is that everybody has a right to an opinion. There might be some opinions that are so vulgar you don't want to hear them. But I think that we have to do that. Again, free speech isn't about speech you agree with. It's about speech you disagree with.
Right on, buddy. Good to see you. Good to hear from you. And hopefully you can return someday.
Yeah, well, come on out to Banff one of these days and we'll treat you right.
Oh, okay. Sounds great.
All right,
thanks.
Guys.
Bruce Dobigan, thank you very much.
Yeah.
See you later, pal. Just let yourself out of the room there and hey Dan,
no.
One second there. Is Mike Boone there in the waiting room? Just look there.
Yes, he is, as a matter of fact.
Well, why don't we just go to Mike Boone now?
All right, let's go to Mike Boone.
All right?
Yeah, sure.
Well, because I just, you know, I'm looking forward to this back and forth between Mike Boone and maybe Phil. I'm not sure what the situation is. Phil is shrugging. In fact, we may even do this. We may forego the Dan Duran news today for what we're
for
about
this,
to hear.
This discussion about...
Well, yes, yesterday,
Sesame Street controversy.
It seemed so innocent. I brought up the point that Sesame Street had adopted this Asian Muppet, and, you know, it made all the news. It made all your news outlets, and I thought this is pretty significant. I threw it off Phil, and Phil seemed to be somewhat indifferent to it.
I thought it was nice, but that's really it.
Okay. And then I heard from Mike Boone, who has an Asian connection. He's not Asian.
I'm more Asian than Phil, I think.
Mm. Okay. And then he just, and then Mike said, Mike said, you know, he went to the waiting room. We didn't see him. Dan didn't see him. And he said, you know, I wanted to add my 2 cents worth. And I thought, well, that's cool. Because he seems to be a little more passionate. The white guy seems more passionate than the Asian guy. So what's your deal, Boone?
Yeah, firstly, I've been enjoying the Dan and Fred show, so congrats to you guys. It's you know, you guys have been doing a great job this week.
Mm-hmm. So, thanks, producer Mike. Thank you.
Right. And I don't blame Dan for missing me in the waiting room yesterday. He had a lot of balls in the air the first show. He's like, he doesn't know what to look in there. But
Not to mention his pecker.
Here we go.
Before I just reference the Sesame Street story really quickly, don't let Dan Duran go to Bodog and bet on like the over-under on soccer scores.
No, I know. That's funny. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I just want to just shine a light on it quickly because it came and went. You had a lot going on this morning. But Dan, who I think of as an intelligent, well-read man, I feel like Dan is aware of everything. And I know people like Dan who don't care about sports. You know, sports is a silly game. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't have time for that. Mm-hmm. You know, but to be so completely unaware of this, the world's most popular sport, that at the age of whatever, 60 or whatever, to be completely, to think maybe 2-1 was
Yeah.
A strange score in soccer and it should be double digits, to me is mind-blowing.
Okay. And I agree. And I touched on a thing, but I didn't want to embarrass the guy either.
There's a big hole in my knowledge. There's a big knowledge gap for me. Mm-hmm. Hey, when I was growing up, there was no soccer. I mean, we played it a little bit, but really it was all about hockey and baseball.
No, I know, but that's really not the point either. It's the world sport and it's around you. You think, as Mike said, over the past 6 decades, you may have gathered that soccer doesn't have a lot of goals scored. But again,
at least I know the World Cup was in Qatar.
Right.
I didn't know when. Right.
Okay, let's get on to the Asian thing.
By the way, our last appearance was in 1980. Canada's last appearance in the world.
I knew. Like, it was crazy.
Okay, so I heard you bring this up, Fred, about Asian representation on Sesame Street, and I was surprised Phil was so completely indifferent. And I'm just here to share this. Okay, so I grew up a white man, much like yourself, Dan, and yourself, Fred. I've been a white guy my whole life. We're represented everywhere, so this is not even in our mind of consciousness. Then I had a couple of kids, also white people, represented absolutely everywhere. King of Kensington to, you know, whatever. All over. I don't know why I picked on that. Okay, because you killed Al Waxman. That's why I went there.
Yeah. But
suddenly, I fall in love with a beautiful woman of Filipino descent, and we have 2 children. And then my little one, my 5-year-old Morgan, what a doll. I notice she starts gravitating towards Asian characters on her, whether it be a Disney Plus show or a Netflix show, and she has an Asian doll, if you will, and then I start to see how she reacts to seeing a reflection of herself on the screen. So what I've noticed the last few years is that representation matters. Like, being able to see somebody just like you on your show is something we basically, Fred, I guess I'm telling you and Dan, that we never thought about this.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we?
Well, why would we?
Right.
I mean, I grew up in a mostly white world. I mean, there weren't a lot of, there was some Asian people, very few black people. So it really wasn't part of our world.
Exactly. Okay. And I think it's amazing. Yeah. I just think it's excellent. I'm here in favor of this. I love the fact, now my kids are a bit old for Sesame Street now, but I love the fact that like little 2-year-old Morgan can see kind of a character that looks like her and can kind of relate to this reflection, that this didn't exist back in the day, and I'm glad it's here now because we're in the most diverse city in the world, and it's wonderful, I think.
Well, you know, I mean, to be fair to Phil, that's basically what he said. It's very nice.
I'm not actually attacking Phil. I just I thought he'd have a bit more passion.
Phil's not even listening. He's talking to somebody else.
No, my sister across the table is listening to you, Mike, right now, and she's basically saying it's nice to have representation in media, but we have our own representation. She and I grew up as kids, of course, as Asians in Canada. But guess what? We had that. It was CFMT. It was Omni 2. It was the cable channels that spoke our language. We have our own things.
Right, but Netflix, Phil, because you, your parents emigrated.
IU. It's not like we aren't represented. We know where to go. That's all.
Sure, but the next generation, right, like your kids, will probably not be tuning into what we called ethnic programming, right? And they're going to be tuning into what everyone else in class is tuning into, the Netflix shows, Sesame Street and stuff.
My kids would have a representation of media like I would. I would be watching ethnic stuff and Gilmore Girls. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a personal choice in the end. If you want to look for it, go ahead. Sesame Street in the Philippines, they had a version 30 years ago. Sure. We have it. It's just, if you don't discover it yourself, mm-hmm. then who knows what you can find, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
This is, you know, we're on a medium that's on the internet right now. I can watch Cambodian live TV or Taiwanese live TV on YouTube. We have our way.
I'm here to.
Like we need to watch PBS. It's
okay, I'm here to say what you've got is your own segregated stream. All you can go that way and go into
it's
that.
It's not segregated when you're on YouTube live. It's not. You find your own stuff to watch. Like, that's all. At the end of the day, you watch your own stuff to watch. I'm from Brampton. It doesn't matter what I watch as long as I know that it's there. Netflix isn't like some ethnic channel, but they've got series in Asian languages.
Huh.
My mother watches Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so like, how do you get let my daughter like know that there's a in Tagalog? She's got to learn a new language, but she can watch a Filipino
Tagalog. Mm-hmm. She's Cambodian.
Sesame Street.
Well, no, gentlemen.
I mean, yeah.
Well, gentlemen,
I'm glad that you can watch the regular Sesame Street and see a reflection of this great mosaic.
It's nice, but. We don't need Western culture to tell us what our culture is made of because it exists.
I think we can wrap this up by saying each to their own. I've enjoyed this episode of Point Counterpoint. I agree with you both. Obviously, it's a personal thing. Mike, you displayed your personal experience. Phil has his. There's really not a right or a wrong in this situation, is there, gentlemen?
No. And we've also found out Phil likes Gilmore Girls, which we didn't
yes.
Who cares, right? Who cares what you watch.
About Gilmore Girls? Everybody cares about Gilmore Girls.
Love that show.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Mike.
Okay. Goodbye, everybody.
Okay. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Okay, Dan, maybe quickly, you know, the Dan Duran news to roll this thing out for, you know.
All right. Let's
do that. Of this show in this form.
Now, here's to a fella named Dan Duran, a hell of a guy with a hella big wang, the quintessential anchor man. His voice is nice and low.
Huh.
Dan Duran, the anchor man, comes. As for credentials, he has none. Can't tell a headline from his bum, but his voice is nice and low. Dan Duran, the anchorman's here. He's prone to falling off his chair, but he's got a big wang, so he don't care. And his voice is nice and low.
My voice is nice and low.
All right, from the Dan Duran newsroom, here's some news. Today is Geographic Information Systems Day. To help celebrate GIS Day, use geographical systems to help society better understand and address issues such as climate change, transportation planning, and population and demographic data.
Mm-hmm.
Russia, the guys with the missiles are not talking to the guys with the rockets. Seems the Ruskies fired a missile at a satellite and blew it up. I guess to show that they can fire a missile at a satellite and blow it up. The satellite was Russian and dead. So it wasn't a big deal politically, except now instead of one piece of space junk up there, there are 1,500 pieces added to the collection that's flying around the Earth that could threaten, you know, all kinds of things like other satellites and the ISS with Russians on board. In fact, the astronauts were instructed to go to their safe space, wherever it is on the ISS, while the debris zoomed by. And there was a couple of events where they thought it might get a little bit close, a couple of passes. So they had to go into their capsules or whatever and then came back. The Russians are defending themselves and saying, well, you know, we thought about it and there's no real big deal. But everybody else is saying, yeah, it's a big deal because now you've just added a whole bunch of stuff in the band that a lot of orbiting satellites and things are. Just interesting that...
Yeah,
one part, like putting everyone else in danger in that space, right?
Interesting to you. I've noticed through this segment, you sort of gravitate towards the sort of sci-fi stories that about halfway through lose me. But that's me. That's me.
Okay. You well, know, did I lose you on the space? They track all the species of space junk out there. Yeah, I mean, there's a big space.
I don't know. Maybe I'm tired. I'm fatigued or something. But no, those stories. I know you guys like all the sci-fi stuff and what's going on. You know, in situations like that, it's great.
Well,
it's great.
It could have. I mean, they're maneuvering a space station in and out to avoid.
No, I know.
All
I
know. The time.
Scares the shit out of me. And actually, it really does.
Yeah. Well, that's why you'd never
all
be.
All right.
Me.
Thank you, Dan Duran. And there we go. Our friend Tim Niblett. Tim, can you hear us?
I certainly can. Good morning, guys.
And we can hear you. How are things going?
Bonjour, Philippe. It's great. I had an awesome day getting home safe and sound Monday. Saw lots of pals yesterday. I will say, Fred, as somebody who's just endured 20 hours driving south, get out and stretch, my man. My back is killing me. So you don't want to have tight everything and a sore back and get some golfing in South Carolina there.
How, I guess going across the border into the States, no problem?
Yeah, it was fantastic. One of kind of the subjects tying in with what I'm talking about today is, you know, I've got a Nexus card. I don't know if you've got a Nexus card at all.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, they're the best, right? I mean, it wasn't bad. I went across a Peace Bridge, but the Nexus, there was nobody in front of me, and the cars were only about three or four, which is no big deal. But boy, whether it's at the airport, I know Howard and Rachel both have them. Whether it's at the airport, at the border, that Nexus card's the best invention ever.
Mm-hmm. Where are you right now?
I am in Florida, down. We're just north of Tampa, Dan, about 45 minutes north of the airport.
Oh, okay, good. Hey, are were we supposed to play the Sherpa theme? Was that part of the thing?
Well, you would think so, wouldn't you? Yeah. But that's okay. Phil can hum a few bars or something.
Well, there we go. See.
All right.
Yeah. Anyway. So welcome to the show then. So I'm trying to do a little bit of what Howard does.
Yeah, you know, a few glitches without the, you know, the main bus driver here, you know. But today you wanted to talk about Canadians driving across the border, as you just mentioned, and what are the rules going and returning from the States, flying, driving, insurance coverage, that type of thing. Because it's very important. Like, I mean, people are charging across the border now that it's, the ban or whatever you want to call it's been lifted.
Right. So my caveat on that would be, you know, it's a pretty fluid situation, right? So what we kind of believe to be true right now may or may not stay that way. But when I flew down in July for Lorna's birthday, when I flew down in September when the Florida Gators were still a good football team, and when I drove across this week, there's just been a little differences each time too, right? With the quarantine and then you didn't need to, and the pre-testing and then you didn't need to. And so, you know, people should definitely just triple check at Canada.ca or wherever Google takes them to make sure they're current on things for sure.
What about insurance coverage? What's the situation with people, you know?
Right. So, and I'll get back to the differences between flying and driving across the border, because that's of interest to people, I believe.
Yeah.
I get calls, it feels like weekly, from pals that are going down, and I'm apparently a pseudo expert on that thing there.
Well, you got a call from me yesterday.
I did, exactly. That proves my point right there.
Yeah.
But I was golfing, Fred. You're bugging me, you know?
No, I know. I'm sorry.
I think I bogeyed that hole, you know, because I couldn't focus.
Probably.
So, or because I'm not good. I'm not sure which one the reason is for that. But where were we? Insurance. Yeah. So actually, just recently, most insurers have changed their policies to actually cover if you get COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, we had to buy specific COVID insurance separate from our like group benefit plan, like a chamber plan sort of thing. And so most people will be covered for COVID now going forward. Again, definitely want to check with your insurer. Definitely make sure that you know what's covered and what's not. Because of course they're all a little bit different, but yeah, that's one nice thing that I mentioned, the quarantine. Now you don't have to quarantine when you return, and now you probably don't need extra COVID insurance. So those are a couple of progressive things that have happened.
Well, that's another endorsement of the vaccine, isn't it? If insurance companies are willing to cover you for COVID now, they must feel that the chances of getting a severe case have been lessened by the vaccine. Does yeah. that make sense?
Absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Very, very good sign. You know, for all the naysayers that exist, and there's lots of people out there. So, of course, there's going to be some of everything. But, you know, the numbers have gone down for a reason. The deaths have gone down for a reason. Mm-hmm. The severity has gone down for a reason. And you're bang on. I mean, the insurance companies are definitely not in the business of losing money. So mm-hmm. if they're including that in there at no additional charge, that's, I think, a very positive sign. Absolutely.
Okay, quickly, the differences between flying and driving. There are, they remain?
I think it was even a little different going to Europe for Humble and GFR. So I'm just commenting on the US part specifically. But to fly down, you've got to have proof of a rapid test, just the kind of short one or whatever, and being fine, and vaccination, of course. But for the States, and I had a cool experience at the Peace Bridge I want to share, but yeah, you just have to be double vaxxed. You don't even have to have a negative test to drive across the border. So that's a big difference on the driving versus flying thing. The returning is the same regardless. You need the ArriveCan app. Mm-hmm. Get that through the Play Store. You've got to have that filled out and all the info in there before getting to the border, of course. And it makes things fairly smooth, actually, when you've got that. But you do have to have what's called a PCR test, regardless of whether you're flying back or driving back. And that's got to have been taken 72 hours before your expected return. So if you're flying back on a Sunday at 1 p.m., you got to have the test done after the Thursday at 1 p.m. I mean, if your flight's delayed, that's not on you. But within 72 hours of return, because it takes on average 1 to 2 days to get the results.
Right.
So you need to get it, get her done.
And again, you had told me, like, Walgreens down there, and I had called down yesterday, they'll do the PCR test, but they send it out, so you have to wait 24, 48 hours. There are places down there that will give you instant results, but you pay for it. So that's sort of a crapshoot as far as, you know, if you want to save money and take the chance or whatever it is. But you said you've had no problems with Walgreens. Did I say Walmart? I meant Walgreens.
Or yeah, did no, I say no, Walgreens? You said Walgreens for sure.
Yeah.
So I'm sure CVS or any number of the other pharmacies would have it. Mine's been as quick as 24 hours, as long as 48. It's never been 72. So, yeah, if you go to more of a private place or more of a health-specific care place, you could spend $200 to $300 to get the test done. And I don't think it's because I'm here in Florida that I got it for free. I think it'll be the same experience for you and your pals in South Carolina.
Yes.
They just do that for the greater good, right? So there shouldn't be any cost at all to doing it.
Well, this is good information because, again, we're getting into the colder weather now, and there's a lot of people that, you know, a year ago wouldn't consider going to the States, even if the border had been open, because of where we were with COVID. And now what we know and what we've had and vaccines and all that, there's going to be a lot of people traveling. And you just know there's going to be a lot of people coming home, too, that aren't up to snuff with what you have to do and will have problems at the border. So it's good to get the information out there. And again, what was your Peace Bridge story before we get to Dan Duran's news?
Yeah, so this was really cool. So every year, Lauren and I fill out a form 8870, which is for the IRS. It's a closer connection form. So really, we've spoken about it before. If you're 100 plus days in the winter, well, any time of the year in the States, you should really be filling these out, sending it to the IRS, keeping a copy on your file, because they just want to make sure that you have a closer connection, whether it's owning a residence, whether it's working, all of the above, in another country, in this case, Canada. And so, but we've always wondered, you know, do they track this or not? And I've always assumed they do, right? We always feel that computers and systems exist for a reason. So when I'm going across the Peace Bridge on Sunday, the agent there, TSA agent, goes, how many days were you down in September? And that's the first time I've ever had that, right? And I said, oh, about eight or nine days. Of course, I again said when the Gators were a good football team. I'm still a little bitter. And he goes, well, how about July? Was it 20 days? And I go, no, it was about the 8 or 9 days again. We were down for my wife's birthday. So that was the first tangible evidence we ever had of what I'd suspected all along, understandably, that they know, you know,
it's being tracked.
If they've been good or bad, and if you're sleeping or you're awake, right?
No, actually, I think it was the chip that they put in your vaccine. They know where you are. They know where you are.
That could be it, but again, my 5G reception is so much better, so I feel it's a fair trade-off there.
So, Tim, what the worry then, I would imagine, is that if you're there too many days, then you're also paying taxes in the States as well as Canada, or you screw up your tax situation. Is that what you're talking about?
It's a possibility, absolutely, right? Right. Well, first off, you're just not really allowed to be there for longer than that. I always keep threatening Dan to figure out kind of the genesis to this rule existing. The things usually exist for a reason. But yeah, that's probably the biggest reason is if you're more than that, then, you know, the IRS would probably like to take a little bit of your income in the form of taxes.
Right. And how many days are you allowed to be out of Canada?
It's 182. Some think it's a trailing 12, like the last 12 months, right? We've always believed it's a calendar year. I mean, the form we fill out, the 1135 or 8870, sorry, is a calendar year. Some think so there's lots of rumors and uncertainty on this, like anything. Some pals think that if you go back to Canada for 3 days and return, those 3 days still count as being in the States. I don't believe so, but they just want to ensure that you're not. Which is crazy because we're spending money and furthering the economy, right? But they, I guess, want to make sure you're not freeloading too.
Well, a lot of things in our world don't make sense. Tim Nublett, thank you very much. That was very timely information today. A little extended visit. But again, everybody can relate to this. A lot of people are going south and, you know, you're our man on the scene with all the information. Thank you very much.
Mon plaisir. Have a great week, guys, and enjoy your trip, my friend.
Okay, buddy. I will. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the tunes, Dan.
I'm getting there.
Hey, bowdog.eu/sports is where to go to wager on all your favorite sports, including the four major league sports here, you know, in North America. The line is out for tomorrow night's Thursday nighter. NFL, New England, a 7-point pick over Atlanta. The Falcons pay $250 to win. Bodog, you know, spend some time with it. If you enjoy your sports and you don't mind, you know, wagering a little coin on this or that, it really is a fascinating thing. Whether you're a sports bettor, a horse racing fan, a poker, a casino player, Bodog, your number one source of online gambling entertainment, from their industry-leading odds, world-class sportsbook, and feature-rich poker room to their fully loaded casino and racebook, they've been providing Canadian players with an unparalleled gaming experience since 1994. Bodog.eu/sports. All right. Dan Duran.
Yes.
Do you have anything left here?
Yeah, the health gauge is something you got to think about. Is your health always? And there's all kinds of people using wearable devices now. The health gauge device is really interesting. You can it tracks your health. Many are using wearable devices or special apps to monitor all of the well-being aspects of yourself, and this gets into pretty good detail. It uses sensors such as electrocardiographs, red, infrared, and green LED to get real-time data to measure things like blood pressure, oxygen saturation, heart rate, pulse wave velocity, activity levels, calories burned. There's a lot of information that is then communicated to your devices. And HealthGauge is putting this together. You can get a special deal at healthgauge.com with the this discount code HumbleFredHG. That's a 15% discount at checkout. HumbleFredHG for 15% off, and that's healthgage.com.
This brings us to the end. Play music. This brings us to the end.
Thank you for that cue.
This brings us to the end of another Humble and Fred show / Dan sitting in for Howard, who's in Venice. Thank you very much, fellas, and we'll see you again tomorrow.
One more time tomorrow for me on this chair.
Right on, brother.
Before you go.
This episode of Humble and Fred is brought to you by the Retirement Sherpa, Gig Sky, The Chambers Plan, Health Gage, Bowdog, and our newest sponsor, Doer, D-U-E-R, the world's most comfortable pants. We stream to the planet from the remote headquarters of the Humble and Fred Show. More Fred and Dan tomorrow and online at humbleandfred.com.
From the habitations and the towns we know, a place we saw the lights turn low, the jigsaw jazz and the get fresh flow, pulling out jobs and jamboree handouts, two turntables and a microphone. Bottles and cans, or just clap your hands, or just clap your hands. Where's that?